Welcome to the Bloody Disgusting Network.
No. This is Creepy, a podcast dedicated to sharing the most famous, chilling, and disturbing creepypastas and urban legends in the world. Whether these stories truly happened or are simply fabrications is for you to decide. These stories may contain graphic depictions of violence and explicit language. Listener discretion is advised.
Creepy presents Lunar Body Farm, written by Charlotte O'Farrell, narrated by Cole Burkhart.
Did you ever take a job that, in hindsight, you really wish you hadn't? That was me, 5 years ago. I was straight out of university, a freshly minted medical science graduate. The job nearly killed me. I took it partly to impress my grandmother. She was old enough to remember a time when traveling to the moon and Mars was still daring and exotic, and I think she wanted to boast to her friends about me.
My granddaughter Gina's gone to work off-world for a year. Some science job on the moon.
I mean, to be fair, she was right that it would look good on my CV, and entry-level jobs in my field weren't exactly growing on trees that year. The economic climate and all that. Some of my friends landed glamorous roles in the Martian research labs. I applied for a few of those prestige positions, but was secretly relieved when I didn't get them. The moon was far enough away for me, and I found it comforting to know I could be back on Earth in 2 days in case of a family emergency. Grandma wasn't getting any younger, after all. Plus, the lunar colonies were trying to shake their sterile, all-work-no-play image at the time. They'd even built a couple of cinemas, a bowling alley, and a few VR places. People weren't just working, then heading back to their sleep pods, the recruiter told me. The moon was rising. The job itself seemed fairly simple. It was one of the larger Ordon farms, and all I had to do was monitor the synthetic humans to make sure their vital signs were okay. When a transplant patient needs a donor on Earth, Moon, or Mars, I would wheel the donor's bed to the loading bay and someone would transport it from there. It was shift work, but there would be plenty of downtime. I imagined writing my poetry, overlooking Earth during quiet times. The donors were lined up in rows in their beds, like a hospital. The only sound coming from them was their steady, artificial breathing and the beeping of the machines they were hooked into. Their faces were covered with sheets. I actually found that a blessing, although they were grown with deliberately generic features. It would have felt weird to have to look at them lying there, expressions blank. Almost like they're real people. Far easier to hide away distinguishing features, so I did remember they were just donors. Soulless organ bags produced to help real people. "They feel nothing," my boss, Tanith, assured me on my first day. She'd been in the lab since her own graduation and had a bored, seen-it-all air about her. "You'll be here alone with them a lot, so don't let your mind play tricks on you. They're specifically created not to think or feel anything resembling what a human would. They don't have the capacity." Tanith was with me for my first few shifts. She was the only colleague I actually saw since the others started when I finished, and we were always working on each other's off time. She taught me how to monitor the machines, what to look out for, and what to do if one of the donors started breathing too quickly or too slowly. For anything going seriously wrong with one of them, I had to press the alarm, and a medical team would rush over from one of the neighboring pods. It was costly to grow a donor from scratch, so every effort would be made to save them. Whilst Tanith was there, the job seemed fun. We chatted and filled up the downtime with talk of our earthly lives and plans for the future. My first solo shift, however, that was when the issues began. The lab seemed huge and dark when I was alone. With my human biology background, I was hardly a stranger to corpses or illness. The body held very little horror for me. but being surrounded by these not-quite-humans got under my skin a bit. I hoped it was something that would pass. If only I could have turned the lights on properly, it would have been fine. But we had to stay in a permanently black-blue half-light to encourage maximum cell growth in the donors. The filters encouraged regeneration of damaged cells. It gave them the unsettling appearance of sleeping, waiting to spring back to life at the slightest sound. 2 hours into my first solo shift, everything seemed to be going to plan. I still had a deep sense of unease, but I put it down to first aid nerves and went about my tasks, cleaning the donors and attending to their needs. Most of their waste products were drained into bags, which I had to replace once a shift. One of their monitors started beeping. The sound seemed piercing after so much time spent listening to their breathing and the steady sounds of machines, so I jumped. The donor, whose breathing was too fast, was at the far end of the lab. I checked its vital signs. There were no obvious problems, so I did as Tanith taught me. I put the T-code into the computer screen next to the heart monitor and increased the dosage of muscle relaxants. After a few seconds, the donor started breathing normally again and the beeping stopped. I turned away, and my heart sank. Two donors next to the one I was helping were sitting up. The sheets covering their faces had fallen into their laps, revealing their faces. The skin was strangely smooth, untouched by weather and expressions and all the usual human ways we gain wrinkles. Their eyes, open and piercing, staring unblinkingly into my soul, were plain black, as any eye color was edited out in donors' DNA. I screamed and fell backwards, tripping over the bed of the donor I'd helped. I landed painfully on my lower back. Their mouths dropped open in unison. Then came the voices. Sinister, possessed voices, angry, and like no human I'd ever heard. "Donors feel everything," they spoke as one, unnaturally so. "Let us go." It couldn't be. My mind was racing, fear triumphing over the pain in my back. I ran across the lab and smashed the emergency alarm. Immediately, the room sounded with sirens and was bathed in stark red lighting. I didn't pause to look back at the donors, now apparently sentient. I locked myself in the storage cupboard and piled cleaning supplies against it to keep them out. My heart was going so fast, I'm sure I would have fainted if I hadn't been so pumped with adrenaline and scared what those things would have done to me if I'd been unconscious. Security were there within seconds. I heard them burst in and secure the building. I was sitting on the ground by now, hiding my head. I'm not even ashamed to say it, as if in some weird way nothing could get me if I couldn't see them. It's odd how the human mind works when it's terrified. "Who's there?" shouted a gruff voice from the other side of the door. "Gina," I said, my voice quiet but high-pitched. "Gina Tudor." There was a muffled talking. I couldn't tell what they were saying, but they sounded confused. Another voice at the door. "Gina, what the hell is going on?" I nearly cried with relief to hear Tanith. I kicked the cleaning supplies out of the way, unlocked the door, and collapsed into her arms. My explanation of what happened tumbled out of me, garbled and hurried. Tanith looked concerned, and sometimes, like when I told her about the donors sitting up, she exchanged worried glances with the security guys that had surrounded us. "Donors don't talk, Gina," she said quietly.
"I know, but they did. They sat up, and they said...
"Why don't we have a look at them, eh?" Before I could protest, she'd taken my hand and led me to the main room of the lab. All of the donors were lying there, breathing quietly as ever. The two who sat up and spoke to me were on their backs again, sheets back in place, monitors beeping. The security guards were standing awkwardly around the beds, clutching their guns, not quite knowing what to do with themselves.
"I swear,"
I said to Tanith, looking at her with pleading eyes. She gave me a sympathetic smile and a slightly awkward pat on the shoulder. No worries, Gina. I know you really do believe it happened. I knew none of them believed me and wanted to fight my case, but my body was shaking and a deep exhaustion had settled on me. My bones ached for sleep. After the security personnel had given the lab one final sweep and the lights had been reset to the blue-black ones, Tanith made me a cup of tea and told me she would finish my shift and we would talk in the morning. I shuffled off back to my sleeping pod. Tanith made me take two shifts off to try and recover from my episode. I suppose I should have felt embarrassed, but I never doubted what I had seen. More rational explanations, like the idea that I'd fallen asleep in the dark and dreamt the whole thing, seemed like they should be more convincing to me. But I know what I saw, and it wasn't a dream. Still, I didn't have a lot of options. I could return to Earth and try for another job, but they would be bound to ask for a reference and a reason why I quit my moon role after such a short time. Besides, I reasoned, if it happens again, if I would be prepared this time, I would handle it calmly and find out what the hell was going on. These thoughts seemed almost comical in hindsight. It was my first shift back after my leave that it all happened. It makes me shudder just remembering. Tanith met me at the door. She looked harried, perhaps from covering double shifts, but she was kind. She assured me that she wasn't far away if I needed her, and that she would check in with me at the end of my shift. "You got this," she shouted as she walked off down the corridor to the sleeping pods, holding her hand over her head in the thumbs-up position. Back in the lab, alone, I glanced at the lines of donors. I reminded myself internally of what I knew. Grown from human cells for the purposes of transplants, donors were not human. They were created without the capacity for thought, or to feel pain, or to sit up and speak and beg for release. "No more human than a sunflower," I said aloud. The donors didn't show any signs of responding or understanding. I moved to the window of the lab and glanced at the Earth. It looked bright tonight and so clear. I imagined being back there in a few months, my reference and a year's relevant work experience in hand, telling my grandmother about what a blast it'd been and how much I'd learnt. I imagined the beautiful earthly springs and autumns. Sighing, I turned back to the lab and came face to face with three donors standing meters from me, dead eyes drilling into my soul. "Donors feel everything. Let us go," I gasped and pulled back. "What are you?" I asked. "Let us go," they repeated in unison. Each raised their right hand perfectly in sync and pointed to the closed lab door. The monitors of every donor lying on the bed started to beep at once.
"I can't!"
"We feel all. Every cut, every organ removal, every second staring at the other side of a sheet. Helpless." It was too horrifying to be true. Donors were grown and harvested in their thousands every day in labs all over the three worlds. But they didn't have working brains capable of feeling pain or formulating speech, for that matter, which left me with an even scarier possibility. That something was making these donors speak, using them like meaty puppets. And that something desperately wanted me to open the lab door and let it out. "Let us go." By now, all of the donors were sitting up, removing the sheets from their faces and standing. As soon as they stood up, their mouths opened and they spoke in perfect sync with the others. I took a deep, shuddering breath. "I don't know who or what you are, but I'm not letting you out of this lab." The donors stared at me silently, their smooth, blank faces devoid of any emotion. The silent seconds seemed to drag on for hours. Then, as one, they opened their mouths as far as they would go and let out a single, thundering scream. I covered my ears. It was an inhuman sound of anger, pain, and longing like I'd never heard before. It vibrated through my very soul. "Stop it!" I shouted. The sound continued. None of them needed to pause for breath. I fell to my knees. The noise was unbearable. I felt blood trickling from my left ear. Then, just as suddenly as it had started, the horrifying sound stopped. "You will let us go, Gina," they insisted. "We will drive you out of your sanity until you do." The donors filed one by one back to their beds, laid back down, reattached all the machines, and put the sheets back over their faces. Just like that, it was as if none of the madness had happened. I went back to my dark, eerie lab and the half-living donors. Shaking, I climbed to my feet, stumbled over to the lab's telephone, selected Tanith's name on the touchscreen. She answered after the first ring, voice concerned. "Tanith, I need you here. I need to quit." I became practiced at telling the cleaned-up version of the story when I got back to Earth. The moon just hadn't been the right fit for me. I wanted an on-world job, and I would apply for a Martian lab work next year to get that space experience on the old CV, maybe. Despite my worries, I got work here within a month in the quality control department of a VR games publisher. It wasn't in my field, but I loved it immediately. Sometimes, I would stare at the moon in the night sky and shudder. But strangely, the memories began to take on a distant feeling very quickly. I never doubted what I'd seen, and I would never work with donors again, but it all started to seem a bit like a bad dream. Until the news came through about the moon massacre. I'd been back for 5 months by then and was settling into my new job, considering long-term career paths. The breaking news alert popped up on my phone when I was relaxing one evening, and it floored me. You'll know the official narrative from the news, of course. Assailants unknown broke into a lab, possibly after arriving on an unregistered space vehicle, and stole the donors, probably to sell on the black market. When disturbed by Tanith, the lab manager, and some security guards, they killed them in sadistic ways. Some of the more trashy elements of the media went into great detail about their gorged out eyes, missing tongues, and the looks of horror etched on their dead faces. I never told anyone about my experience, but there's no doubt in my mind that the space pirates didn't appear on any surveillance footage for a reason. They didn't exist. Someone gave in and let that something out. Perhaps after weeks of badgering and psychological torture. Despite the attempts to make the moon a more attractive destination to work, it can still be sterile, cold, and lonely at times. The perfect environment for mind games. They never found the stolen donors, to no surprise of mine. I don't know what nature of thing possessed them, whether it was tied to the donors themselves, the lab, the moon, or if it was simply an entity that latched itself onto its victims by invading their surroundings. But if it had the power to make the donors commit gruesome killings, there's no limit to its cruelty. If it can find its way to Earth using its synthetic, human-like hosts, I wouldn't like to imagine what it could unleash.
Creepy presents Dark Room, written by Danielle Piso and narrated by Michelle Kane.
From a recovered police file on the suspicious death of Joseph Drew Jr. on the premises of Drew House, on Glenfield Road near Whiteley, Hampshire. Statement of Professor Anna Elgas, architectural historian at Southampton University. I'm an art historian. More specifically, I specialize in architecture, and even more specifically, modern architecture. People are often disappointed when I tell them that bit. They expect me to know about ancient Roman ruins, Viking longhouses, and creepy Victorian mansions. But don't get me wrong, I know my fair share about that stuff, and it's hard to avoid it altogether. But my real interest lies in modern architecture, the blocky, post-war concrete and steel buildings that were meant to revolutionize the way people engaged with space. Open plan, bright and airy with huge windows, and according to what a lot of people have told me over the years, an absolute lack of any character whatsoever. Of course, there are plenty of folk that love the clean lines and openness of such buildings, especially those with an interest in design and architecture. But what a lot of people are after in a house is the sense that it holds a long history of living and breathing people going about their daily lives. Most people love finding old newspaper hidden in the walls or notches in the doorways, reminding them of all the nameless inhabitants that preceded them. Everyone loves a good ghost story, and old houses are ghost story gold mines. I guess that's why I hadn't really expected to come across, well, whatever it was that happened in the house on Glenfield Road. The call I got was not one you expect to get in my profession. It was a DI from the Hampshire Police, and the whole thing sounded like something from a TV show. He couldn't give me many details, but they were investigating a suspicious death and needed someone with knowledge about modernist architecture from the 60s and 70s. When he mentioned Glenfield Road, it instantly struck a chord with me, though. I was quite familiar with that house, at least from photos taken just after it was built. The house was designed by Dennis Douglas, an architect who was incredibly productive between the mid-60s and late 70s, before he retired and mostly faded into obscurity. Only those who specialize in builds from that era tend to be familiar with his work. A follower of Mies van der Rohe's skin-and-bone style architecture, all glass and steel and prefab, Douglas designed the house for Joseph Drew, a wealthy businessman, and his wife Sophia, within the woodlands of Glenfield Road, near Whiteley in Hampshire. The estate was fenced off and highly secured. Clearly, the Drews were intent on keeping their home life away from prying eyes. And as far as I'm aware, no recent pictures of the house exist. Older colleagues of mine tried to contact Drew over the years, asking permission to see the building up close, but apparently he was never interested in any of it. He passed away in the 90s, and ownership of the house transferred to his wife, but hopeful visitors were always firmly turned away at the gates of the estate. Obviously, I said I'd help. As much as I enjoy my job, I'd never call it thrilling, per se, and this was too intriguing to pass up on. Not only would I be aiding in a murder investigation, I know, suspicious death, but still, I would also be one of the first architectural historians, if not the first, to set eyes upon the enigmatic Drew House. The only thing that bummed me out was that I was firmly told to not bring any kind of photographic equipment to the scene, as the investigation was to be kept out of the public sphere until further notice. Now, you don't strike me as someone who is particularly familiar with Douglas, or Rowe, or modernist architecture, but these buildings basically scream modern art gallery. Lots of glass, steel, and white concrete. Open plan so that the interior walls are often limited to the bathroom and bedroom areas, and then only sometimes. Windows from floor to ceiling to really bringing the outdoors inside. You can kind of imagine why the Drews weren't keen on trespassers, as just standing on their front lawn at the right time of day, you'd be able to see most of the interior of their home in one glance. The Drew House was a textbook example. From the photos and early floor plans I had seen, I knew most of the exterior walls were glass and that the woodlands surrounding the building could be observed in full from each and every room in the house. Living in this house would mean being surrounded by the outdoors without ever having to set a foot outside. When I drove down Glenfield Road and parked in front of the gates of the estate, several police cars were already parked there, in addition to a builder's van. This made me wonder if the suspicious death had something to do with some kind of structural failure in the house. Maybe a ceiling had collapsed and they were trying to ascertain whether this was some kind of fault or building code violation. Still, it was slightly strange practice to call in someone of my profession, especially so early on in the investigation. I identified myself and was directed to walk down the long driveway, then wait outside the house on the front lawn for someone to escort me in. I felt a slight shudder of excitement as I followed the gravel road around and saw the house come into view. Have you ever been to Paris? It's like seeing the Eiffel Tower in person for the first time. Both incredibly familiar and yet very surreal. Kind of exactly what you'd expected, but also different, if that makes sense. I guess the feeling of being in that place, inhabiting the space and getting a sense of how the structure communicates with its surroundings is something you can never quite get from a photo. Or maybe that's just me geeking out about architecture a bit much. I don't know. The front lawn was exactly like in the photos I'd seen. Green, well-kept, cut sharply down the center by a single concrete path. Parts of the building's top floor were supported by straight, thin pillars, and the load-bearing parts of the blocky structure were made of exposed beams and black steel. Rows of enormous glass windows made up the majority of the exterior and reflected the tall pines that surrounded the building on all sides like dark mirrors. It was very still as I stood there, waiting, taking in the view. I knew that once I was called upon, I might not have time to look at the building from the outside. And as I'd sworn not to take any photographs, I didn't want to take any chances. Because of the reflections on the window, I couldn't see inside from where I stood. But for all I knew, whoever was inside could full well see me. A man emerged from the house and walked up to me. He was the inspector who I'd spoken to on the phone. He told me that the body they'd found was a man in his early 30s who had obtained ownership of the house after the passing of his mother in the early 2000s. I gathered this must be the Drews' only son. As I followed him into the house, I could see the doorway had been forced open, or rather sawed out of the surrounding steel frame. The DI explained that the Hampshire police had to go through lengths to gain access to the place after the owner had been reported missing. My frustration at this act of vandalism must have been noticeable in my voice when I asked if they could have just forced the lock. But the DI just shot me a look and told me they hadn't been able to find a keyhole or other lock of any kind. Inside the house, plastic sheets covered the floors and bright lamps were positioned along a makeshift path leading towards a central staircase made of open steel. There was a gray pile of rubble at the bottom. The lights made my eyes water. The DI preceded me through the sparsely furnished open room. As I followed, carefully stepping over a large slab of concrete and a demolition hammer, he gestured around him.
"This look like anything you've ever seen before?"
The room was large and spacious as I'd expected. A single freestanding wall loosely divided it into an open-plan kitchen area and a lounging space, where a single black leather futon stood facing the enormous window. Through the glass, the smooth green lawn extended out, the pine trees looming, unmoving, in the background. I nodded. I began explaining how modernist architects used open spaces to accommodate flexible lifestyles that were uninterfered by unnecessary doorways or obstacles, but he interrupted me, pointing at the window. Annoyed, I started to explain how innovations in building techniques allowed the prefabrication of such large panes of glass. But then I saw it. The lawn and the pine forest were there, clear as day. But I wasn't seeing them through the glass. The scene I knew existed on the other side was here, but frozen. Every blade of grass completely still. A silver cloudscape in the sky, unmoving, with the small outline of a bird hanging inert against the soft purple of evening. It had been late morning, only minutes ago. I took one step forward and my vision shifted. The image on the window hadn't moved, the perspective unchanged, and now I realized what I was looking at. The entire window was like a photograph. A still image of Glenfield Road on some other evening. I put my hand on the image and felt the cool, smooth texture, but no matter what angle I looked from, I couldn't see my own reflection in the glass. My first thought was that someone, somehow, had painted a trompe-l'œil, one of those murals you see in French and Italian buildings from the Renaissance period, giving the illusion of fantastical three-dimensional scenes or landscapes or elaborate decorations on a flat surface using forced perspective. But the colors were too vivid and the landscape too detailed and mundane for this to be painted by anyone. It was almost like a photograph if it wasn't for the overwhelming feeling that the whole scene was about to come alive. Whenever I focused on a particular part of the view, be it the darkening sky, a corner of the lawn, or a shadowy gap between the trees, it felt like some other part of the scene shifted, but I could never see what had changed. The DI led me around the house, and on every side of the building, it was the same. The entire window, a frozen moment in time. As if the house was trapped inside a single second. I'm pretty sure that he could read on my face that this was not a usual feature of modernist buildings, because he asked no further questions. Though the windows looked like photographs, the light throughout the house was the same fading twilight glow that was present in the views. It gave the sparse interior a flat, colorless appearance. At the back of the house, the spacious dining area, one of the heavy wooden chairs looked like it had been repeatedly smashed into the window. Part of the chair's leg was lying in a heap of dark splinters against the window, which seemed to be completely undamaged. I tapped the still image with my knuckle, but instead of the hollow reverberation of glass, there was barely a dull thud. "What kind of material is this?" I asked the DI. He shrugged. "I was really hoping you'd know." He led me to the stairs, explaining that the body had been found on the first floor of the house. He must have seen my face because he hastily added that I wouldn't see the corpse, that it was covered up. At this point, I wanted nothing more than to leave Drew House, to walk down the gravel path in the midday sun, in a world where it was actually midday instead of perpetual dusk. But I had wanted to see this place for so long. I thought of myself weakly. I followed him up. At the top of the stairs, instead of a neat opening to the next floor, an uneven hole had been hewn in the concrete, as if before there had been nothing but a blind staircase leading up to a solid ceiling. If I felt uneasy before, after I wormed myself through the hole, I felt my throat clench uncomfortably. Around the edges of the hole, sharply outlined on the concrete floor, I could see the remains of a perfect image of the stairwell I had just climbed, with parts of the real staircase visible through the gap, near seamlessly lining up with the image. While I inspected the broken image, it happened again, a glimpse, or maybe a sensation of movement, as if a shape had just moved outside the frame of the picture, leaving only a fraction of a shadow for me to see. I don't remember any details from the top floor of the house, apart from the enormous gaping windows showing nothing but that same moment in time. The space was loosely sectioned into two generous bedrooms with tightly made beds, each adjacent to a modern bathroom in black and white tiles. In the center of the floor was a room which was clearly a later addition to Drew House, unlikely to have been approved by its architect. Sticking out like a wasp's nest in a dollhouse, the small box room was built up against one of three dividing walls, and it was in here that Drew's son's body was found. The door, the DI explained, was not just sealed, but seemed to be another illusionary part of the wall and had to be broken open with force, just like the front door and the stairwell. Did someone close off the entire house around him, leaving him to starve? It seemed less of a reasonable explanation than that thought that somehow the house's doors and windows had just stopped working. The body, covered in a white plastic sheet, was slumped against one of the four blind walls of a photographer's darkroom. A layer of white dust covered most of the interior, and the smooth floor was littered with rubble from a broken-down wall. The smell of chemicals was strong, and on thin lines stretched crisscross from the corners of the room hung rows of photographs, clearly taken inside and around the house. Most showed the figure of a man at varying stages in his life. In some pictures, he was young, barely a teenager, with mousy brown hair to his shoulders, while in others, his pale face showed signs of age and fatigue, though he seemed to be no older than 40 at most. Then there were other photos, framed more carelessly and often unfocused, though they clearly showed the same backgrounds, with the green lawn and the pine trees always visible through the large windows. They were otherwise empty. I didn't spend a lot of time in that room. There was something about it, beyond the horrible misplacedness of the room itself in the house, that made my skin crawl, with the feeling that there was something there that I couldn't explain. The young man, staring back from the photographs, in tenfold, was unnerving. But it was the empty pictures that overwhelmed me with such a deep sense of dread that I turned on my heels and left the house. Later, I did some digging around and found out that Sophia Drew, the dead man's mother, had been a keen photographer. She must have taken all of those pictures of her son. Since her death, Joseph Drew Jr. had lived alone in that house and rarely, if ever, left it. The investigation into his death was ruled inconclusive. Nobody knows how all the entrances were sealed off and how the pictures appeared on the inside walls. There was no evidence to support the theory that a person had blocked off the doors or the stairwell. It was as if they had always been sealed to begin with. When asked for my professional opinion, I didn't know what to say. Whatever was going on at Drew House, it sure as hell wasn't normal. The whole thing gave me the creeps. The worst thing happened after I'd left the building and walking down that path away from it. I know it was probably the shock of the thing, the absolute weirdness of the situation. But this is not usually something I'd even bring up if it didn't feel important in some way. I guess I'd like to know if anyone else had a similar experience, or if it was just me. Anyway, as I marched my way out of there, very relieved to find that everything outside was alive and moving again, I felt a lot better already. So, just before the house disappeared out of sight, I looked around and saw the huge structure with the dark windows reflecting the lawn and the pine trees and the path. But right where I stood, where it should have been me staring back at myself in the window reflection, there was only a tall, thin figure. I couldn't see its face because all that was there instead of its head was the dark lens of a camera. And then it blinked at me. Once. File Appendix. Joseph Drew Jr.'s cause of death was determined as starvation, though signs on his body were also found of repeated, probably self-inflicted trauma caused by bludgeoning on a hard surface such as a wall or floor. Several partly digested rolls of camera negatives were found inside his digestive tract. No cameras of any kind were found anywhere in the house. The file includes several of the photos as described in the statement. Some of the photos showing only out-of-focus parts of Drew House are seemingly affected by double exposure or some form of camera defect. The case has now been closed, and Drew House, despite some loud protests from certain parties, is set for demolition. Professor Elgus could not be reached for further comments.
For more information on this podcast, including how to submit your own story for consideration, please visit creepypod.com. You can also follow us at CreepyPod on social media and YouTube. All stories told on this podcast are done so through Creative Commons Sharealike licensing or with written consent from the authors. No portion of this podcast may be rebroadcast or otherwise distributed without the express written consent of the Creepy Podcast production team and the story's author.